Hello and welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns. I'm Peter Lavelle. Here we discuss some real news. During his State of the Union address, Joe Biden invoked history, specifically the Second World War. On this edition of the program, we explain why this history is abused. Also, voters throughout the Western world go to the polls this year. Will their voices be heard? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Goggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And in Marrakesh, we have Martin Jay. He is an award-winning journalist and commentator. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with George in Budapest. You and I have previously talked about the State of the Union address that Joe Biden delivered. Obviously, the most bizarre thing coming from on that venue for that occasion we've ever heard in our lifetime. But it was very interesting. It was supposed to be the State of the Union, but it was the kind of the state of Joe Biden's mind and administration, particularly when it comes to world affairs. So the United States didn't feature very much, at least in the beginning. But the Second World War, he teed off with the Second World War, as if the United States in 2024 is in a similar circumstance who was in January, or I guess it was March then, of 1941. That the world is coming apart at the wheels, off the rails, and that the United States must lead. I'll let you take it from here, George, because his understanding of history is not only wrong, but it's kind of perverse. Go ahead.
You're absolutely right, Peter. It has to have been one of the most bizarre State of the Union addresses ever delivered by any president. He kicked off, as you say, the State of the Union by referencing January 1941 and suggested that America was in that situation that it was then. Now, in that year, within 11 months, the United States was at war, a world war. It was a war with Japan and Germany. So you have to wonder then, is that the plan for this year? Since he said that this we're in exactly the same situation that we were in 1941. And in fact, he said it is worse because we have this existential threat in worldwide, and we have an existential threat at home. So it's an almighty crisis. So you have to then wonder what's the plan here. I mean, is he planning to lead the country into war? And then you also have to wonder about what's been going on in Europe this week with Macron denouncing the Germans for cowardice, that their lack of zeal in sending the Taurus missiles to Ukraine demonstrates cowardice. And this was echoed also by the British, David Cameron, the foreign minister, saying, no, you know, this is not escalation. Just send everything you've got. Just send it all to Ukraine.
I suppose, George, the French can say that because the Red Army didn't come visiting in 1945. I suppose that had something. But they did in Germany.
Right. That's right. And then Macron, he had all of the political parties assembled at the Elysee Palace. He, you know, had a meeting with all of them, and he had addressed a number of states in Europe, in which he again reiterated that, well, if things get bad in Ukraine, we're going to have to be there. We're going.
Well, I mean, George, you and I have talked about this before. NATO troops, does that mean French troops, or that means, you know, the Baltic republics? It means Poland? Does it mean Romania? I mean, who's going to do the heavy lifting here? Or is it just the United States? You know, Martin, one of the interesting things, too, George and I and yourself are very fastidious about history. And if we look at the first months of 1941, the United States, at least the official narrative was, is trying to stay out of the wars, to stay out of the European war and try to avoid war with Japan. That's the nominal history here. But Joe Biden is he's not avoiding war. He is wanting to perpetuate war, to continue war. I mean, the analogy to 1941 is upside down and inside out, because Joe Biden, with a couple of phone calls, could these existential threats that he claims could be dealt with immediately. Martin.
Yeah, he wants to keep the war going as it is, as a proxy war, but he doesn't want to involve American troops or NATO troops for that matter, you know, and I think you have to ask yourself why. And I hope Americans are becoming more and more cynical and asking the same question, you know, is there something else there that we don't know about? You know, when we look at his son's activities, his business dealings in Ukraine, are there other, you know, great corruption stories there which will come out in the next few years? You know, it's very dubious and very suspicious, but I think that if there's any question about who wrote his speech, I think he wrote it himself. Because to go back in history that far and to not really make any prolific statements or comparisons to today, but just simply show that you have an idea about what history has and what history has done and where America is now is foolish, because the world's changed. And I think his key message was, I'm stuck in the past. You know, I only really care about the past. I think an awful lot of Americans will be saying, well, what about healthcare? What about pump prices and food in the supermarket? Can we deal with realities of today? And I think the word that came up, well, first of all, I think a lot of the speech was basically written about Trump. I think it was really all about Trump. But there were a lot of references I noticed to trickle-down effect. And I think this is one of his obsessions now, is that, look, the economy isn't in a bad state, and it isn't. He's fudged the statistics a little bit in the respect that some of the positive statistics about jobs, for example, aren't really realistic unless you give them context that when he came into office, we were all coming out of COVID. So obviously the pendulum swung the other way on growth, on jobs, and on inflation.
Well, but Martin, you know, I don't want to go into the weeds about the economics of it, because I think it's just patently false what he had to say. But at the very least, the elites are doing fine. That was the message. Yeah. The elites are doing fine. You know, we're doing just Jim Dandy here.
But okay? how do you win an election?
Why can't everybody else, you know, accept our well-being?
How do you win an election on that? You know, we're doing great. We're buying new Learjets.
Yeah, well, that's a problem we're going to discuss as we go into this election season here. But George, you know, who wrote the speech? Well, that elite wrote the speech, okay? Because Mike Johnson, you could see maybe he was clapping under the table. I'm not really sure, but he was certainly nodding his head, okay? So this is, again, the uniparty. This is the very, very bipartisan. I mean, even the highest-ranking elected Republican official sitting right behind the president of the United States said, that's right, Mr. President. Considering everything else is coming apart, they have an agreement on that at the very, very top, George.
No, it is quite remarkable. And that is a very good question as to why you start off a State of the Union, which is supposed to be the State of the Union today, and then you bring up some event from more than 80 years ago. And yes, he is stuck in the past, but as is America's elite, and as is Europe's elite, you know, when you listen to Macron, you listen to David Cameron, they are exactly the same as Biden. They are stuck in this mindset of Hitler, Churchill, Chamberlain, and that's how they try to read what's going on in the world. And it is so bizarre because the public just isn't buying it. The public does not think that what's going on in Ukraine is some existential matter for them that they have to worry about, that it somehow in any way threatens them. But that's how essentially they're selling a war, because they have no other means of selling war. They have no other means of telling them why they're doing what they're doing. I mean, that's really the question. Why are you so heavily involved in Ukraine? And they don't have an answer other than bring up, oh, well, if it's Hitler, well, of course, everything is on the table. If it's Hitler, well, if it's them, then, you know, we're facing Hitler. So therefore, we need to go to war.
The problem with that, George, is that how many Hitlers are out there? We keep hearing it. Okay?
That's right. But they don't have
everywhere.
Any other. Yes, that's right. But they don't have any means at their disposal. They've never been able to explain why is Ukraine so important, other than to bring up Hitler. Well, we have to stop Hitler. You know, we stopped him before in the 1940s, so we've got to do it now. And that's all they got. The problem is that this rhetorical excesses acquire a momentum of their own, and it becomes very difficult to stop, because if you're facing Hitler, well, you can't just simply say at one certain point, okay, well, that's it, boys, let's go home now. But didn't you say that we were fighting Hitler? So, you know, and that's why with Macron, it's getting more and more weird with all these proclamations that, well, we have to, you know, get ready for war. And they, and we now have the stories of the French are being trained to fight a war in Europe. You know, they're busy training in Africa to fight a war in Europe. It's in the story of Politico today. So this is where they're heading.
You know, Mark, it's what's really, again, really bizarre about this speech is that there was no reference or suggestion of how to move towards peace. That was absent. Yeah. It's as if there's no options out there. That there's nothing else. You're a prisoner of some of this reenactment of history, Martin.
Yeah, but the references to Ukraine and getting the bill passed, you know, to carry on with the spending was very brief, I thought. I mean, it was really short. You know, you would expect he would have put a bit more meat on the bone and really hammered the point hard, you know, that Putin's this evil dictator and he's going to take over all of Europe and we're next, because that's what the journalists have been pumping out for weeks now. And even government ministers like my idiotic defense minister who recently visited Kiev and did this piece to camera, because we don't have journalists anymore that do interviews. We don't have journalists anymore that ask our ministers difficult questions. What we have is ministers who've had their media training and that they know their buddies come along with their little iPhone and they do a piece to camera. And this was explained to us that, you know, we need to carry on. We need to support the Ukrainians and help them win this war. But I think with Biden, he's got himself into a very tight corner because, you know, I think an awful lot of Americans are not really taking him very seriously. And they don't see him as somebody who can really fly the flag internationally, you know, just dragging us more and more into international, you know, disputes.
Well, he came across as a dog barking at cars, George. Yeah. I mean, that's how I kind of read it here. But again, you know, stressing that they're somehow prisoners of their policy. And in Martin, you say put more meat on the bones here. I think, you know, what people say, did I miss the Netflix series on Munich? Because what is he talking about? George, 40 seconds before we go to the break.
Well, that's right. And he has been a prisoner of this policy from the start. And it was his decision to get so involved. Yep. In a war in which there were no obvious American interests at stake. And he has done this and he has continued to escalate and he has continued to push the Europeans and persuading them that this is an existential matter for you. This is Hitler. And now they are indeed prisoners of this policy. And it's very hard to see how they get off.
Yeah. And just as George said in the beginning, maybe Biden was prophesizing what the end of the year will look like. We'll see. Gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns. I'm Peter Lavelle here. We're discussing some real news. Okay, let's go back to Budapest. George, we had this amazing election outcome recently with George Galloway, someone that you and I have dealt with in the past. A supremely wonderful human being. Yes, I said that, everyone. I know everywhere else you hear his name mentioned that he is demonized, but no, he's a wonderful, gifted politician from the working class, which I totally respect. But George, is this a taste of what we can get for the throughout the Western world? Because George Galloway is a known element. It wasn't an accident. People voted for him for a reason, and they know what he stands for. Is this going to be stand as an example of what the elites will have to be fearful of this year?
Well, one would hope so, but one has to be a little bit skeptical when it comes to the United Kingdom, for instance, because there has to be an election sometime before the end of this year. Galloway has done this before. He has won by-elections before, and then he didn't succeed in winning a re-election. Very, very hard in Britain, as I think Martin will say, very hard to break through that two-party system. I'm not sure why, but it's almost impossible to break that two-party system. You know, it's almost 100 years since that this was last achieved. I think he is a populist beacon, and I think that there will be a populist movement in Europe in the coming months. We've seen that in the farmers' protests, which have spread throughout Europe. And what's remarkable about these protests is that they enjoy widespread support. I mean, it's yeah. they're being thoroughly obnoxious, and yet the public is entirely on their side. And then we're seeing some major movements in Germany. I mean, we have this the official parties, the rainbow, the traffic light coalition. The traffic light coalition. Deeply unpopular, and now there's the Alternative for Deutschland doing clearly very well in the polls, and now there's a new kind of left-wing populist party, again very similar to George Galloway's party, but Sarah Wagenknecht could well break through in this year. Macron is also in a lot of trouble. So, you know, we have the National Rally Party also looking like they're going to do well. So there could well be a major shakeup. And again, as we were talking about in the first half, if Macron keeps going down this path of threatening France with war against Russia, he's heading for an almighty shellacking in the European elections in June, because clearly the French public is not with him on this one.
It's really interesting, as you were giving your answer, Martin was nodding his head. It's not, the problem isn't the ideas, the problem is the system, because the system will not allow new ideas to percolate to the top or to be heard. It's very interesting to me, because I said in my introduction, I mean, will the voters be, they'll vote, but will their vote count? Okay, that's one of the problems that I see facing us right now, because it's no coincidence that, you know, we hear through Western capitals, help to prepare for war. Well, that means the suspension of domestic issues, of domestic debate. You have to have the everyone has to rally around the flag. Unfortunately, the flag is being held and controlled by neoliberals. Martin.
Yeah, and also it's a massive, massive media distraction, which you know, elites now are really feasting on. You know, we've had a few over the last few decades, and in the last few years as well. We had COVID, you know, then Ukraine was for a long time it took up a massive amount of media oxygen, and now it's as though all these elites have got together and said, "Well, look, our economies are in a mess. You know, we can't really nail inflation. Jobs, unemployment is starting to spin out of control. We haven't got any policies. We don't have a silver bullet. You know, the only thing that we can come up with is, can we find more cash? Can we tax the system even more?" And it's the same, I think, the same situation in the European Union elections. You know, you have now Ursula von der Leyen, who is going to try and stay for a second term. She's going to run for a second term. It doesn't happen very often in the EU. It's only happened once in the last...
Oh, you know, the EU will just coronate her, and we'll just have Queen Ursula, I think. Keep going.
Exactly. But what is her rallying call? And her rallying call of Macron and Schulz and Sunak is also the same, is we need to spend more money on defense. And that is just really the biggest scam ever. That's like electric cars, you know? That's like, why do we need to spend more money on defense? You know, to keep you in jobs, to keep the elite where they need to be, you know, to keep them in control because policies are failing. And I think if we look at, for me, the big one is that there's 20 elections, something like 20 elections in Europe, you know, old Europe as well, and Russia. And I think for me, the European elections is going to be a milestone in EU history, because I think we are going to have a lot of populist votes. And that is going to change how the EU functions. When we have a decent number of MEPs in the European Parliament that can slow down the entire bureaucratic process and start coming up with some common sense policies on the environment, on international conflict, and such forth, I think that's going to be a game changer. And I wonder if Ursula von der Leyen stating that she's going to run for a second term is actually going to even drive more people to vote for populist votes. Because people are sick of the EU, you know, and you know, it's the French are sick of the EU because it doesn't work anymore. It just doesn't. People don't see the benefits anymore. All they can see is an institution that's out of control that wants to spend and spend and spend more and more and more money. But no one sees any tangible, you know, result.
But you lived in Brussels. But the EU takes care of people in the EU in Brussels.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of
that's what buffets. It does really well.
Good buffets, you know? Mark, George. A lot of good. Will it translate? See, this is what I'm worried about is that I think there people have ideas and they're rethinking a lot of the real problems that beset the Western world. But will they be allowed to have that voice expressed? They can vote, but we all know, you know, even if you get 50% plus 1% of the vote. it doesn't necessarily mean change is going to come about. And that's where the tension is going to start. And George, Viktor Orban's not going to be considered such an outlier, I think, by the end of the year. Go ahead.
Well, what you said is very, very, very important, because, you know, we talk about the populists, and, you know, we talk about the German populists, the Alternative for Deutschland. We can talk about the Sarah Wagenknecht party. But the reality is, when it comes to governing, it is very hard for the outside parties to make that breakthrough, because let's say, you know, they really do really well. Well, what happens? That means all the establishment parties just get together and say, well, under no circumstances will we let the outsiders have any say in governing. You know, we'll set up a completely a coalition of all the.
I think that's this like the new Sweden model.
That's it. We're not going to have that. I mean, we had that with Geert Wilders in the Netherlands again. We're just going to keep him out. And I think the same thing is going to be in France. No matter how well the national rally does in the European elections, Macron will continue with his policy. I mean, look at the people that he has in government. I mean, the new people he's appointed, you know, they sound as belligerent as he is. He's determined on this policy. He knew when he hauled in all of these the politicians and told them that his plan is to save Ukraine, whatever it takes. And he said that, well, there are no red lines. I don't recognize any red lines. There are no limits to our support for Ukraine. I mean, he knew that they wouldn't like it at all. They said, hey, what the hell are you doing? You know, you're dragging us into war. He doesn't care. So that's the problem, that the elites just simply go ahead with their policies. And look, we know in the UK, Keir Starmer, he's not going to change anything from what Rishi Sunak has been doing.
Yeah, because Martin, they're speaking to and reacting to their donors and the center of power, which is Washington. I mean, French president in his or right mind would be saying these things now, but they're addressing Washington. They're not addressing the farmers in France. I mean, we've said over and over again on this program, this is all about elite capture, because that's the only way you can explain why they ignore their electorate. I mean, Annalena Baerbock, at least she's honest in saying, I don't care what my voters think. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, but I wonder if I'm less skeptical as you are. I wonder if these elections that we'll have this year will be a turning point. And I think the election of George Galloway in the UK, that may well be an indicator. That may well be a sign that times are changing, and that will be a new generation of independent MPs, you know, mavericks like Malloway. I mean, I love George. I really do. I don't agree with his domestic politics. I'm not from the left, but I love the guy, because whatever you say against him, he is consistent with his policies. He is principled, and there, when you think of somebody of my age who reflects on, you know, the last 30 years or so, how many people in the parliament that we have in Britain can we say the same about? You know, these days our parliamentarians are wishy-washy, opaque, corrupt little individuals, grey men in grey suits, who are basically a lot of the time on the take, looking for ways to subsidise their salaries, because you can't live on an MP's salary if you live in London. It's just, you know, you've got to do something else. And so corruption is sort of, we're adopting the American model, but people like Galloway, you know, could shake the system up and could set the example for other MPs to come in. And I think that may well happen. But let me make my point. The thing about these new independents, because you were skeptical, to counter your point, I think they will make a difference. And the reason why is, excuse me, because people like Galloway come with their own media. They bring an entire infrastructure of social media with them, you know, and this makes a difference. This does shake the system up. You know, the elites, the old elites, can't ignore what someone like Galloway can do in one afternoon on Twitter.
Yeah. You know, George, it's very interesting what Martin said, you know, that, you know, yeah, we've talked with George Galloway. Yes, he is a man of the left. But I think what makes him attractive is not the fact that he's from the left. It is that there's an authenticity and a road record that goes along with him. And I think across the political spectrum, you say, well, I don't really agree with him on that, but he's a person that is authentic and genuine. And I think that counts, because we all know the rest of them are just complete fakes. Go ahead, George.
No, absolutely right. He's certainly authentic. And I don't think it's entirely right to describe him as a man of the left. I mean, I think
it's more complicated, yes.
Exactly. He would acknowledge that he has many socially very conservative views. And he is someone who I think, you know, well, that's why I won't describe him as a populist, because he does try to articulate the hopes and the fears of the ordinary people. And so, you know, they say, hey, the people that I represent have actually very socially conservative views. Yes. And when it comes to this issue like immigration, he's very much takes a very conservative view. And I think that's also true of the Sarah Wagenknecht in Germany, who's also said that, you know, has some socially conservative views. And again,
okay, well, we're going to end on a positive note. We usually don't do that. We've run out of time. I want to thank my guests in Marrakesh and in Budapest. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.